I want to have all of you join me in welcoming tonight's speaker, Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immisland, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know if most of you didn't hear the announcements tonight because they were given while we were all eating and they got dulled off. But last night they were clear and distinct. And I was thinking about that because I have kind of a reputation for being kind of a hard-nosed or some old cynical person, and I'm not. Down deep, I'm like a big pussycat. I was thinking last night, if I had one day left to live, I would like to come here from wherever I was and listen to those announcements. So it would make that last day seem like forever. Well, he took his phone back now. Well, I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober. I really enjoyed the weekend. I thought the AA show, over the years, I probably have written and directed 25 AA shows, and I've been in several more. But I must say, the show they did last at the AA show was the best show I've ever seen on an AA stage. It really was great. But it's easy if you've got singers who can sing, you know. And I certainly enjoyed the talk last night by Carl, my friend Carl. He and I have something in common. You have kind of two Scandinavians who went bad speaking Friday and Saturday night. He's not here tonight. I guess he heard what he came to hear last night. But he gave a great talk, and I've come from the same kind of background, Norwegian Lutherans, and up in Wisconsin, however, not Seattle. And I was raised in a Norwegian Lutheran church, and I was catechized and confirmed and did very well. My parents were fine, upstanding people. And I shoved ahead in school twice because I could read fast. By the time I was 11 or 12, I was getting straight A's in school and on my way to becoming governor of Wisconsin, really. And my parents got a divorce, which doesn't, everybody gets a divorce. But can you imagine, I had never heard of a divorce when my parents got divorced. There are none in our family, none in our church. And that disturbed me a great deal and went through a lot of things. But 3 years later, I was flunking out of high school. I just became a sarcastic, nasty, anti-person. And what saved me is the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and I plotted after that. When I turned 15, I left. I told my mother I was going to Superior, Wisconsin to visit my aunt, and I got a little bag of clothes, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. I had no idea what the hell I was going about. This tall, a face full of pimples, and I was going to go out and enlist in the Marine Corps or something. And I said, you can't get into any service at all. You're just a kid, obviously. But one guy said, you might want to get in the Merchant Marine, because they're taking anybody with a warm body. So many people have gone to the Navy. So I went to the Coast Guard office, and I said, I would be in the Merchant Marine. He said, well, fill out this application. And they told me to put down 16, so I put down 16. Then he said, well, you're only 16. You'll have to have this approved by your parents. So I took it around the block, got it approved by my parents. That afternoon, I was a load of torpedo warheads going to the South Pacific. And I sailed when I was 17, I joined the Navy, like Carl did, and I joined the Navy, and I did pretty well in the Navy, all in all, except at that time I didn't like to drink. Guys got me to drink whiskey, and I hated it, didn't like beer. And so I did pretty well. I was kind of snotty and insolent, got in trouble sometimes. But at the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital outside of San Francisco being sewed together, and they passed around some tests. I was been great on tests because I read rapidly. So I did so well. I remember the guy coming to me, he said, Clancy, it's hard to believe, but you're in the top 5% of the Navy intelligence. And I said, I know. But what that did for me, they gave me a high school diploma from the Armed Forces Institute. So I went back after the war and went to the University of Wisconsin. And I don't think there were very many people around here who remember 1946. But in 1946, millions of people got out of the service all at once. They all went to colleges and universities because you could go free. You get paid once a month for it. And go to freshman English class, and there'd be some grizzled old veteran in there sitting next to some little honey just out of high school. Were you in the war? Yeah, do you put out? Very rude, but a lot of them did. I found one that didn't. I was married to her for 63 years. I started to drink in college because going with the veterans, we'd go out every time, and I got to develop a great liking for drinking. And all of a sudden, I guess if you cross the line, that's where I crossed the line, because pretty soon I need to keep going. I couldn't seem to function well without something. And by the end of my career, I was doing pretty well in university. I was editor of the paper, and I was chief justice of the student court. And on commencement day, I spoke on behalf of the senior class to cheering throngs. And we marched across the stage and got our diplomas, but mine was blank. And I knew it was going to be blank because I had an incomplete in English history in my last quarter. And it was incomplete because the damn class was at 8 o'clock in the morning. I never got there. And so I had to go to summer school. And I was hired to teach journalism at the Duluth Denfeld High School in Duluth, Minnesota. It was just great. So I went to summer school, and I got a job in the rubber company balancing white sidewall tires. And I'd work all day and stop at a bar and I'd get drunk every night. Not falling down drunk, but pretty. And I'd... Anybody who would listen, I'll tell them a sad story about that stinking university, what they did to me after I did. I won trophies for them, won prizes, and now I had to go to that damn summer school. And one night a girl said, I'm just going through town with a traveling magazine salesman, but look at you, you're rather grubby, your fingernails are dirty. You don't seem to be any kind of a big shot. I said, I'll show you. We went down to the university. I broke a pane of window in the door. Opened the door, went inside, showed her the trophy case with my pictures and trophies. As I recall it, she was overcome and slumped to the floor. I don't remember exactly, I was drinking heavily, but I thought she'd had a flat tire. I was trying to pump her up as best I could. And a policeman's flashlight illuminated. If you want to talk about a passion quencher, try that one. What are you doing there? Nothing anymore, officer. And they arrested us and took us downtown. And charged me with breaking and entering in the nighttime, a felony, penitentiary offense. That's what they charged her with. Then overnight, the university got to them, and they just reduced it to drunk and disorderly again. But I went on court that morning. God, I felt sick. And the judge was a friend of our family. And before the court started, the guy brought a box in with all my personal effects from the university, a note on top from the dean saying, I covered for you as long as I can, but I can't cover this one. You're expelled. And I go, God, that's bad news. I got a telegram from Duluth saying my contract had been abrogated on the grounds of moral turpitude. And then I had to face that judge. He says, Clancy, I regret you're that sorry. I said, why is that, Judge? He says, when people are that sorry, they're not only sorry for what they've done, but what they're going to do. I thought, oh, no, Judge. Oh, no, I'm done doing bad things forever. Well, so that changed my life. I think about that sometimes. I'm glad I didn't go to Duluth. I'd have been a drunken journalism teacher till about November, and then they'd put me on an ice floe and push me out in Lake Superior, and that'd be the end of me. I meant well. But I got a job as a sports writer on a newspaper, which is my favorite job to this day. I'm still anticipating the football game tomorrow. And I loved it, and I married this girl, dark, black-haired girl, black eyes, flashing, mysterious. And after she won my heart, she announced, I'm a Catholic. Oh, Jesus. At that time, Lutherans didn't marry Catholics. But she won my heart, and she had me trapped, and we got married. And then after I got this good job as a newspaper guy, she began manifesting the behavior pattern of Catholics that I did not know about and no Lutheran kid ever learned. And that is, if you marry a nice Catholic girl, a good Catholic girl, you are about to have a bigger family than you ever dreamed. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Boom. 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 So I had to get better jobs. I had the flair for writing. I got to work at a big corporation, Fairbanks Morse, in their advertising department. I did very well, drinking heavily, writing well. One day they called me in and said, "Clancy, you're doing a good job, but we need you here on Mondays too." And Tuesday morning when you come in, you smell bad. And if you have to do something about that, we can't keep you here. And fortunately, when I was a senior in university, I'd been drinking, got a lot of little trouble, disorderly conduct things, and being hollering at cops. So some friends of mine had said, "Why don't you go to this thing downtown, new thing called Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "I'm not an alcoholic." They said, "We know that, but some of the town drunks are down there is easing up, and maybe you won't get arrested anymore." So I went to my first day meeting in the spring of 1950, a long time ago. Went to this room, 8 fat guys sitting around a table. One said, "What the hell are you doing here?" I now know why he said that, because I was 22. I looked even younger, and there wasn't anybody in that state under 40 in AA, like some kid 8 years old tonight coming in saying, "I think I'm an alcoholic." "Oh, do you? I think you have a broken nose." You know. But for those who are new here tonight, it doesn't take long to learn about AA. Alcoholics are people who drink too much alcohol. They come to AA and admit it, and that makes them feel better. They return to God. They show their gratitude by helping others for the rest of their life. What a dreary prospect. But I sat there for a while. But when they called me into the office at Fairbanks Morse, that came to my mind. I said, "You're right, Mr. Carlson. I got drinking overseas." That was touched their heart. And they got this new thing downtown in Beloit called Alcoholics Anonymous. "If you give me a 2-week paid vacation, I'll go down there and get well and come back and go to work." He said, "Right, you can do that." "Yes, sir." So I went to AA in that town. There's 10 fat guys sitting around the table doing nothing but talk to how much they drank. And I could see nothing was going to help me there. But the one thing it did for me, it helped me at home. I was able to go home to my wife and say, "Well, I've gone back to Alcoholics Anonymous." "Wonderful, wonderful. What do they want you to do, honey?" "Well, they want me to taper off." And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a minute's rest for any slipper anywhere. "Now you're about to stop complaining. We have the same book you do, and we have the same steps. I release you, you son of a bitch." But that started a pattern. I could see I wasn't going to do any good there, so I got another job in another city. And I did that for the next almost 10 years. I worked for a place, got a good aura, till my behavior screwed up, and I had to get a leave of absence to go to AA, and then I'd go somewhere else and get a job. And I finally went down to Dallas, where I didn't come back up. I'd had a lot of jobs, good jobs, doing well there. But the guy called me and said, "You know, Clancy, you're a talented man." He said, "But you almost cost us the Fritos account last week, multi-million dollar account, with your damn drunken stupidity. You're done here, and I'm trying to make it my business to see you'll never have another job in advertising." Well, things don't work out always. And I knew I had to get out of the state because, unfortunately, I was on parole from the state mental hospital there. And I knew my wife would probably turn me in, because anything goes bad, they turn on you. So I got a guy, asked me if I'd knew anybody who'd drive his car to Los Angeles. I said, "Sure, I will." He said, "But you're supposed to work at Tracy Hawk." I said, "I quit, bunch of phonies." So I got a car, and away I went. First day I got as far as El Paso, almost 600 miles. I used to work at the university there. I'm big in El Paso. I'm bigger in Juarez. By midnight, I was down at the Chinese palace, standing on the bar, singing my little song. Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua. And my fans were saying, cabrón, cabrón. I think that means welcome in Spanish. And the next day I got as far as Phoenix, 300 miles. I wasn't making quite such good time then. And I didn't know anybody in Phoenix, so I had to hide the car. So I hid it well. And I haven't found it since. It was, all my money, all my ID, all my clothing. That night I was on the streets looking for frantically a guy. Would you help me find my car? He said, don't bother me, kid. I said, for Christ's sake, help me find my car. I got to find it. He said, don't bother me. And I grabbed him by the lapels. He said, you shouldn't have done that. He took out his badge, took me to jail, threw me in the jail. I'm going to cool you off, boy. When you go to a jail, it's 130 degrees. It really don't cool off real quick. But I got to sleep fine. In the middle of the night, I was so sick. Oh, I got up and had to vomit. Turned to be somebody's bed. Nobody was in it. How would I know? And then I laid down on the floor. I'm sure some of you have done this. After you throw up, just put your cheek against some cold tile. Oh, God, that feels good. I went and slept like a baby. This guy came back from wherever he was, who'd bunking was, found his bed full of vomit and drunken fool. You don't care! He kicked me. I didn't mean to, I'm sure, but he kicked my front teeth out. You think that's funny? When did I get to the part where I die of leukemia? I bet you like that. Anyway. And I was very grateful I'd been in psychoanalysis for several years before that. I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, that son of a bitch is overreacting. But I got to jail the next morning, covered with blood and vomit and no front teeth. Didn't know anybody in Phoenix. But I knew one thing I'd learned in the past few years of my heavy drinking. When you really get in trouble and have no place to go, nobody wants a thing to do with you, there's one place you're always welcome, an AA club. It's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Jim. So I found the Arid Club in Phoenix and went over there and hustled some old lady for $20. Got on a bus and came to Los Angeles and got a hold of a guy who had given me a start. He's a big star now. He had me come out to Hollywood and he gave me a bunch of money. I told him I'd been in a car accident. He said, oh, you poor guy. And he said, if you need any more, let me know. And I got a little room and drank and had fun. And I called him back in 3 days. I said, I'm out of money, Ted. Could you help me a little bit more? He said, Clancy, I called Dallas. You haven't had a car accident. You're a bum. Everybody says you're a bum now. You used to be a great guy, but you're a bum. Don't bother me. I know, Jesus, Ted, for old time's sake. He's okay. You come to the alley back of the station tonight, back of Hollywood Boulevard. Don't come to the front door like you did the other day. You know, 9 o'clock tonight, I may come out the drive, may go out the fire escape, but maybe have something for you. So I was out there at 8:30 in the rain. He said, Clancy, you make me sick. He threw a $5 bill that tousled down into the mud puddle. And I crawled out and got that. The boy really fooled him. And the next night I woke up at an all-night theater on Skid Row. I don't know if you're familiar with all-night theaters. They have them in metropolitan areas downtown, where they don't really run all night. They run till 5 o'clock, and they're designed for drunken bums on the street to go sleep. Well, you got no place to sleep. You can get a ticket for about 30, 35 cents. But they came in 5 o'clock with hoses and say, okay, everybody out, everybody out. And I came out of there in the rain. Oh, so sick. Stood in the lobby, what the hell am I going to do? The guy said, you want to sell a pint of blood? I said, Jesus, do I ever. And he took me 8 blocks up the street to blood bank. And we came in and they took a drop of blood out of our ear. And we sat there and waited. And pretty soon a guy came out and said, you kid, you don't have enough iron in your blood to sell a pint of blood. Sorry, you're gone. I said, Jesus, I'm so sick. Please help me. He said, we got enough for you. Down here about 4 blocks, there's a place designed for people like you. It's called the Midnight Mission. It's designed for bums and no goods like you. Go down there and get some breakfast. Thanks. I went down in the rain with the midnight. I said, I'd like some breakfast, please. Guy said, oh, we just got done serving. Sorry. Come back at lunch. We'll give you a big lunch. I can't wait till lunch. He said, I'm so sick. Give me something to eat, will you? He said, we have no more food. And I grabbed him by the lapel. Bad habit of mine. And two guys came over, each and peeled one hand and threw me out the door and said, don't come back, you son of a bitch. And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a son of a bitch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, if you're old enough to remember these, the Elsie Mirage of the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's hard to explain these things in midair. Yeah. And I stood outside that old mission and I didn't know what to do. In the rain, if some guy had come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120 some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, I used to call you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes. Look at you. Nobody even wants you around. Your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you. Your stepfather's so tired of watching you play and her emotions, so she'll go down to her tiny little bank account, take a few more dollars, and send it to her little boy. He'd rather have her think you're dead the way you are. He said, you've been going to AA now on the country for almost 10 years, and you sit in these meetings when the heat is on, and you sneer at these idiots and their little steps, and their little traditions, and their little sayings, and their, we love you, and thank God, I wish I were stupid like these idiots. And now you're dying. He might have said, why don't you go back to AA one more time and at least admit you're an alcoholic. And if someone had said that to me, and if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have fell. You don't understand. I'm not really an alcoholic. By that time, I wish I were. I wish I were an alcoholic. I would give anything to be able to sit in those damn meetings and feel better, but I feel worse if you know those idiots talk. Nothing helps me. I've gone to psychoanalysis. I've tried everything. Another reason I know I'm not an alcoholic, alcoholics can't stop drinking. Everybody knows that. When they start to drink, they just drink. And I, not me, I stopped a number of times when I had to. My problem has always been after I stop in a day or two or three or four, somebody sneaks into my bedroom at night and puts an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. It just comes out as a little restlessness, a little irritability with the bad breaks I'm getting, a little tired of all the crap I'm taking, get my daily sermon from the kitchen. Why don't you shut up from there? Little by little, watch whatever technicolor there is in my life slowly go back to gray. Pretty soon my job is gray. And my family is gray, and this town is gray, and I get so damn sick of these goofs. And I've done everything. I've spent thousands of dollars to overcome that syndrome. But I'll tell you how you overcome it. Eventually, when it gets bad enough. Oh, Jesus, that's good. But then you must say, I'm going to watch it this time. Never know, you can't or you won't. But that's happened to me time after time. If I was an alcoholic, when I stopped drinking, I'd feel better. But my problem is not alcohol. My problem is maybe neurosis, maybe even mild psychosis. Something inside of me is screwed up, I know that. Kindness is something I remember. I don't remember ever going through it. But nobody came up and talked to me in the street. And I finally said to one guy, Christ, it's cold and rainy, I'm dying. What's that AA club around here? Well, there's nothing downtown. Closest one I know is Wilshire and Fairfax. I said, where the hell is that? He said, well, just go up this hill to Hill Street, come over to Wilshire, walk west and come to Fairfax. That sounds pretty easy. Away I went in the rain, sick. And as you know, it's 7.5 miles. It's a long walk when you're sick and every step is painful. I got to that damn old club, I was just about dead. Then I almost didn't go in because there was a guy in the doorway saying, welcome home, son. Oh, shit. But I went in that stinking club and I hated it, everybody in there. And I had no idea that'd be my sobriety date. didn't want it to be. Tonight, when Anne read the tradition so well, I was hitting on her before the meeting, but she didn't respond. I don't care. But when she read the tradition so well tonight, the third tradition stated, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. That's what you're supposed to have. I had no desire to stop drinking at all, because stopping drinking to me is a lethal situation. In the mid-1950s, I went through a little bit of a period, which was not very good, but I'd get to a certain level of drinking, then I'd go out in the streets and hustle police officers, counsel them as best I could. And I got arrested several times for disorderly conduct. And I got so I could get out of jail in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, go home, take a shower, go to work. And one morning I came out of jail and one of my neighbors was standing there. I said, what the hell are you doing here? You shouldn't have come down here. He said, well, I said, I got that cop's badge. I'm going to get his ass. I tell you, he really abused me last night. He said, I don't know about that, but while you're out drunk, we couldn't find you. And your little son died and we couldn't find you. That just about killed me because I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy. And God, I had such hopes for him. And it just, oh, God, that's a terrible feeling. We took him up to Wisconsin and buried him in the foot of his grandmother's grave. And I put my hand in his casket. I said, John Emmisland, this will never happen again. I'm so sorry. I don't know how it ever happened. And I came back and I quit drinking. I didn't go to AA because AA makes me want to drink. I just quit drinking, came home at night, had dinner with my kids, helped them with their schoolwork, tried to be jolly, go for rides. Probably the best 2 or 3 weeks you'd ever had as a family. Every meal we pray, said a little prayer for baby John. And then one night, wouldn't you know it, someone snuck into my bedroom after several weeks and put an invisible spring in my gut. And I got a little tense, but I thought, that'll pass. I'm doing this for baby John. But it didn't pass. It got a little bit worse day by day. And all the old symptoms came back. And I thought, just, Mary, take your sisters and go to your room, for Christ's sake. I'm sorry, I don't mean it. One day I got up, I'm just so terrible. My wife had taken the kids to mass. So I just pulled the car in the garage and hooked up the hose and the exhaust pipe and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. I didn't know what to do, just crazed. The guy next door was happened to be sitting in his breakfast nook having a cup of coffee and somebody went there and heard the motor run. I didn't come out. So he ambled over and found me dead in the car and he pulled me out and I breathed in my chest, I guess, and breathed in my mouth and rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me. Kept me there for several days, and then they examined me mentally and determined I was seriously mentally ill and committed me to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period. That's how I get when I stop drinking. I don't get a euphoria. I go to the state nut house, that's where I go. And you know, in the 1950s, nut houses weren't quite at the level of sophistication they are today. Now you ought to try the fun of going to sleep at night and all of a sudden you hear from far away, Jesus Christ, hold it down over there! And I escaped once. They brought me back, gave me electric shock treatments, and I was there till the next year. You know, that looks bad in an advertising resume. Well, where'd you spend this time? I was self-employed. Thank God for that phrase. But that's how I get my stuff. Why would I want to stop drinking in a rainy place? I eventually wound up sleeping in an abandoned car in the A Club parking lot. That was my home for several weeks. And going to the meetings and having people sneer at me and just hated it. Just terrible. And the manager of the club said, you know, you're supposed to belong to this club to be in here during the week, but since you got no money, you should stay out, but you'll die in our parking lot, you boob. So I'm going to let you come in, but you got to go to a meeting every night. So I said, okay. I went to a meeting every night, just dull, drab, crap, old idiots. But I saw a movie actor in one of the meetings. I thought, ha-ha, what do you know about movie actors? They're rich. I thought, I bet he'd like to have a new friend. So I went up to him. I said, would you like to be my new friend, Bob? It turned out he didn't want a new friend. And it rained all week. And I was living in that damn car and eating, living on cake at the meetings. I ate about 4 pounds of cake a day. Just, my first birthday came, I couldn't eat cake. take your goddamn cake. But I thought, I'll sell out. I'll go all the way with this guy because I got to get out of here. I'm going to die. I'll sell out. So I went to Bob, this actor. I said, Bob, I so admire your program. Would you be my sponsor? He said, okay, I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. I found out soon thereafter he wasn't a movie actor at all. He'd been in 3 movies. He had cameo roles in 3 movies. I'd seen 2 of them, so I thought he was in a lot of movies. I've been in more movies in the last few years than he ever was, but I didn't know that. They said he wasn't a very good actor, but he was a good actor because he acted well at meetings. That was hard for him because he was a right-wing fascist AA puke of the worst water. Just do this, do that. I thought, why am I taking this crap from this idiot? Because he was my only meal ticket out of there. But I look back and he saved my life. And I look back with a great deal of love for Bob. I didn't have any at the time, but went to sleep many nights thinking, I'm going to kill that son of a bitch. But he was a man of strong opinions. And I told him, I said, you know, Bob, I want to be fair with you. I'm not really an alcoholic. I want you to know that. I look like one, I smell like one, but my problem becomes is worse when I'm sober than when I'm drinking. I don't know how to explain it. If I could just find a way to drink and stop in time. He said, okay, we understand that. But he would come down and pick me up once in a while and take me to meetings where he was speaking. And one night he came down, took me to the Brentwood meeting, biggest meeting in town at that time. And before the meeting started, some kid asked to make an announcement. He said, I want to ask, say a few words. He said, I came here about 11 months ago, and I was having a lot of trouble. But you folks pointed out to me I was drinking too much. I never thought of that. I never thought of that. I never thought of drinking could be too much. And I quit drinking that night, and I haven't had a drink since. And my life is fine. My family and I are getting along fine. The job is going good. I don't even miss drinking. I don't come back to your meeting because I have no desire to drink. But I want to thank you very much. And after the meeting, I noticed old Bob, after he spoke, he pounced on this kid. He said, what are you hanging around here for? We don't want you around here. We don't want your kind here. You're taking up space. You made that waste our time. I said, Jesus, that's a little much. On the way home, I said, Bob, why'd you pounce on that kid and oppress him? He said, because he's got an alcohol problem. I said, Bob, I don't want to be offensive, but AA is designed for people with alcohol problems. He says, no, it isn't. People with alcohol problems don't need AA. What do they need, Bob? They need to quit drinking, clean up their act. When they're offered a drink, say no, thank you. I said, that doesn't work. I've been trying that for 10 years, for Christ's sake. That doesn't work, Bob. He said, I guess you don't have an alcohol problem. You must have what I and all the people in AA have, which people many times think they're an alcohol problem till they die from it. Well, what could that be, Bob? He said, it's something that sounds like alcohol that fools a lot of people. Something called alcoholism. I thought, oh, Jesus, Bob, don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than you'd ever believe. Shut up, he said. And he gave me about a 3-hour harangue, most of which I was able to blot out before I went insane. But in that talk, he saved my life. And I didn't know it then, didn't know it thereafter. But I can see it now. He pointed out the difference. He said, alcohol, there are some people who drink alcohol and they drink too much and they quit. And there are some people who drink alcohol and they drink too much and they quit, but they must always start again. And we're talking about the people who can quit and don't have to start again. Those are alcohol problems. They stop, quit drinking, everything is fine. However, this strange thing called alcoholism, which from the first drink on looks exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that. I've been going to meet for 10 years. You'll say, stop drinking, it'll be better. He said, nah. Stopping drinking and not doing anything about it is worse than drinking. I said, my God, Bob. Then why do these alcoholics all drink? All they say is, oh, I drank so much, I got drunk, and I went to jail, got drunk. I said, why do they do drink? so bad for him. He said, they're not drinking because it's so bad for him. He had a Coke in his hand. He said, alcoholics are people who get an unnatural effect from alcohol. You know that? I said, yes, I know that. I've heard that. It's that the phenomenon of craving. Then you drink till you go crazy. He said, nah, that's podium talk. I'll tell you why alcoholics drink. If this were Johnny Walker, and I took a big drink, the immediate result would be to almost alter my position of my perception of reality. The whole world gets a little cheerier, a little brighter. Hi. I had some reason to do that then. And another couple drinks, and I'm glib, and I'm funny, and I'm cute. Pretty soon I just check the bar. Hi, are you with anyone, Granny? That sounds bad, but it isn't. In all the years I drank, I never went to bed with an ugly woman. I got up with a lot of them. They must have changed bodies at night somehow. But drinking enables me to be the kind of person I want to be. Cool and nice and fun. And not that, I'm worried about my rent and I don't like the job and it's screwed me. I used to tell people, alcohol is the best friend I have ever had. Friends come and go. Lovers come and go. Jobs come and go. Cities come and go. States come and go. But when a few drinks is making that miraculous change, there's nothing like it. You can be in Maine or you can be in Guadalajara. It's just great. Now, my problem is I got to find a way not to drink too much. And that's turned out to be the problem. In fact, in chapter 3 in the book, after I was sober a while and I read it again, I ran across something funny. One of the things, you new people, you come to a meeting like this, what do I have in common with all these people? Different sizes and shapes and colors and backgrounds and stories. What the hell do I have in common with them? You don't have much in common, apparently. But one thing in chapter 3 talks about that you and I have in common, and most people like us, I guess everybody. Somewhere along the line in our drinking, we have had to voluntarily or involuntarily accept the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. It says, the perception of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. And boy, that's true. Is there anyone here who hasn't tried little ways to beat that drum? You know, that little thing in the book, changing from one kind of booze to another, drinking beer only, reading spiritual literature, taking exercises, taking trips, not taking trips. The only one of those I'd never tried not taking a trip. When the heat is on, I'm gone. Only cowards stay and face the consequences. But I said, Jesus, Bob, that sounds like me, but what could be the problem? Can you think of my problem? He said, yeah, it's quite obvious, kid. There's a name for people like you. I didn't really want to hear it because he's very profane, unlike me. He said, kid, you're an alcoholic. I said, how can I be an alcoholic? My problem really isn't alcohol all the time. He said, alcoholics aren't people whose problem is alcohol all the time. Alcoholics are people whose answer is alcohol all the time. And if it's your answer, you will hold the problem till you die. And he told me that in December of 1958, a long time ago. And I thought, what if that's true? What if I'm not crazy? What if these explosions of mine are due to some kind of an alcoholic pattern? So I tried staying sober. And I've been sober ever since. No pills, no drinks. But I still was living in the backseat of an abandoned car. I wasn't doing very well at all. I told Bob, I said, you know what, damn it? I used to be something. Last year I made $100,000, and now I'm laying in an abandoned car, taking crap from people I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn last year. He said, well, that means we have to take the steps. I said, I can't take the steps. And the reason I couldn't take the steps, because my little boy died, I cut God off. I shook my fist at God. You took my little boy who never committed a sin and killed him to punish me. Well, screw you, God, son of a bitch. You'll get me in hell, but you won't get me now. Screw you. I never wanted to hear God's word again until I die. And I said, I can't take the steps, Bob. I can't return to God. He said, well, you're lucky. Second step, you don't have to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob. Is that supposed to fool me? I know what the hell they're talking about. He said, look at the damn thing. Nothing in AA ever asks you to return to anything. It says, came to believe. You can look at your childish superstitions any way you want to, but you got to hear, try to come to believe in something. Can't you believe in a loving God? I said, no. He said, can't you believe in AA? I said, well, I like it better than I used to, but not much. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are, Bob. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that because he's trying to help me. He did become a higher power, and he saved my bacon. But that second step, you know, the hardest thing of newcomers, you hear so many interpretations of the steps, you got to somehow stay here long enough to realize they mean what they say and nothing else. They ask you to believe that you're having a problem with alcohol, you're having a worse problem without alcohol, then you've taken step one, that's all. If you come to believe there's a power greater than yourself, what power? Any power you want, Bell. God, ocean, a tree, clothing store, whatever you want. I remember saying to my sponsor, I don't really believe I can. There's a higher power greater than me. He says, get out of the streetlight, take off your clothes. I said, why? He said, you'll see a higher power in a black and white car come along. Take you away. I don't know how they'll grab you. But you have to come to believe there's some power here that's greater than you. And the way you know that is this room is full of people, and they didn't all stay sober to fool you. They stayed sober because they found the power greater than themselves. It's going to do what? Restore me to sanity. I'm not going to turn about all, don't worry, I'm not going to talk about all the steps. But those first three steps have kept more people out of AA than anything I know. Me, guys like me. What does it mean to find a power greater than myself to what? Restore me to sanity. What the hell is sanity? You can read 10 medical textbooks and get 10 different definitions of sanity. Oddly enough, the most common form of insanity is easily identifiable. When the human brain gets under sufficient conflict and can find no way out, just desperate, it will go back to its best last gasp position. It will change its perception of reality. That is called psychosis. And if you become psychotic completely, you're easy to spot and they put you away. But most people has to be triggered by something. You read in the paper, God, I lived next door to this guy for 10 years. Came home one night, took a rifle, killed his kids, killed his wife, killed himself. Why would he do that? Nice guy. Something triggered his psychosis. An odd thing is this, though. This may surprise you. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that odd? You'd think it would be the number one candidates. Why not? A guy in Washington explained that to me. He said, stop, think about it. Any alcoholic who's sober, if he has no program, whatever it is, will eventually feel bad enough till he has to drink alcohol. And what does alcohol do? It alters his perception of reality. You and I have the power to temporarily induce psychosis. Happy days. But tomorrow, you and I will be sane, and the psychotic will never leave that position. So it turns out that what it means, the second step is not very complex. You and I have to come believe there's some power here, whatever that might be, will make it unnecessary for me to ever drink alcohol again. Sounds incredible, but you come to believe it. But then the third step is the last step that just wipes you out. Turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Try that some morning when you can't pay your rent. Here, God. I gave up on that step. I My sponsor suggested I write an inventory. I said, I've taken my inventory with a professional psychiatrist. Why should I take it with the out-of-work actor? That pissed him off like everything else did. And I got a job at the Gaiety Delicatessen on Sunset Boulevard as a dishwasher. And I got fired the first night. And it wasn't my fault. It became clear to me that the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. And I could see they were getting dishes from other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm not Mexican. I just piled them up and I got fired. And I went back to the club that night and everybody had gone home from the meeting and the manager was sitting there waiting to close up at 12. I got there about 11 and I said, DJ Solomon, I lost my job as a dishwasher one day. People I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn are getting jobs, get along with people. I can't get along with anyone. I might as well be drunk. I waited for him to talk me out of it. He said, I believe you're right, Clancy. Well, why do you say that, Sally? He said, well, in the club here, there's about 8 people who like you. And they have to defend you night and day. There are about 150 people here who think you're a real asshole. And they wish you were dead. If you'd get drunk, just think you may make those 8 people that like you feel bad. But you make 150 bastards really feel good. Well, I'm not going to do that, I'll tell you that. I went to the back room and got some paper. I'm going to write my inventory. If you ever write an inventory, try to do it when you feel bad. It sure flows. I mean, when you feel good, it's, oh, I guess I screwed up a few times, but not too much. Made up for it later. But when you feel bad, I'm a dirty son of a bitch. And watch the ink run with your tears drop on the paper. And I got done with it. Oh, God, it's a terrible inventory. I remember thinking, I hate to be this way because I'm not even a good bad man. I'm not a bank robber. I'm not a killer. I'm a cheater and a liar and a user and a rationalizer and a justifier. I hid under the back seat of my car. I guess the manager called Bob at home because Bob called me the next day and said, heard you wrote your inventory. Time to take your fifth step. I said, Bob, I can't do that. I put stuff down there. I don't explain to you. I never would tell my psychiatrist these things. And somebody would say, why didn't you tell your psychiatrist? Because if you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why. Get out of my office. Wash off that chair first. Yeah. But I said, I don't think I can take the inventory. But he said, I'll be down. He came his car down at dinner time and picked me up and took me along the highway to Oxnard, gave me a flashlight, and I read this dreadful thing. Oh, God, it even read worse than I remembered. Just an unsavory person. And he's going to make me walk back to Oxnard. I just knew it. Well, that's about all, Bob. He said, are you done now? He leaned over and said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. But the reason I mention that is this. The day I wrote that inventory is the day I took my third step. I did something I disagreed with that was suggested to me. That's what the third step means. Turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. And for most of us, that speaks through AA. So if you can do those, it's a funny thing. Over the years, I've sponsored a lot of people. If I can get them through those 3 steps, they usually can take the other 9 easily. But if they don't get through those first 3, they're never going to take a meaningful inventory, never going to make amends, never do anything. Because if you're not really an alcoholic, why should you do it? And if it's going to not make any sense. So really, it boils down to Alcoholics Anonymous is really a battle to overcome the first 3 steps. Then it gets easier to write an inventory. Determined to get rid of your defects of your character as best you can. Make amends to people. That's a great series of steps. And the more inventory a little bit. And then, much to my surprise, after a while, when I was about 3 or 4 years sober, my sponsor died. And I thought I should get a sponsor, but who could I get? I settled on a guy that I didn't like. I thought he was a big spiritual puke, but he was very active. That's what I did, an active guy. I got him Chuck Chamberlain. So I called him up at his home. I said, Chuck, this is Clancy. Could I come down and see you tomorrow? He says, yes, come on down to my office. And I went down there to see him. I said, Chuck, I got something to ask you. Would you consider being my sponsor? He said, gee, I'm surprised, Clancy. I heard your talk last week at the Southern California Convention. I thought you were coming down to offer to be mine. So I thought, he's rotten enough for me after all. But somewhere in the first year, he talked about talking to God. And I said, Bob, or Chuck, I cannot return to God. God hates me. He said, kid, I got some bad news for you. You're not important enough to hate, for God to hate. Go home and try to say a prayer. And I did. First prayer I'd said in 15 years, maybe. And little by little, late in my sobriety, I came to believe that there was a God that loved me. And I began praying to him in 1962, I guess. And I've prayed to him every day since. And I thank God for the goodness he gave me. When I was 5 years sober, I'd become director of advertising for a big medical corporation. When I was 7 years sober, another guy we brought to Hollywood. We created something called Boss Radio, became the hottest station in the world. 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for the oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, leaped out of their post office box, fled to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. But it was the little boy, and I was so happy. I cried all morning in St. John's Hospital. And then I got a book on the rhythm system from the Catholic Church. So there's no more of that crap going on, I'll tell you. I remember a lot of times having to say to my wife, sorry, dear, I've got a headache tonight. Now they're all grown up. Three of my daughters turned 22 this year in alcoholic, or last year in Alcoholics Anonymous. And only one of my kids has turned that bad. My oldest daughter, Mary, she's become a judge. We had hoped for a defense attorney, but no. She was home for Christmas a few years ago. I said, Daddy, remember you used to sit my sister's night in our room all the time when you were feeling bad? I said, yeah, sure. She said, when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I have no need to go to New Mexico for any reason whatsoever. But the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is it turns out what AA is for. You know, somewhere in those 15 years, I was doing very well. 15 years, I was doing well. My kids were doing well. Everybody was doing well. I had a big house up by the ocean. And suddenly it struck me one day. I've known for a long time what Alcoholics Anonymous is about, and I never thought about it. Do you know what it's about if you're new? Let me tell you. You think it's to make you dry year and year and year after out? Not really. I'm 54 years sober. I'd be so dry now I'd burst into flame up here. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe this with every fiber of my being, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. It changes my perception of reality. It enables me to live in the world and work at peace successfully. It enables me to have friends and to sponsor people with some degree of responsibility and respectability. And it's very, it doesn't come all at once. It doesn't come boom, just every time you make an amend, you feel better. And you make a, but the trouble is, if you're not used to feeling good, it can take you by surprise. And it took me by surprise. When I was 15 years old, I felt so, hey, I'm really doing good, baby. And one day I felt so good that I went down and resigned my job in Beverly Hills. And for the last 39 years, as of yesterday, have been the managing director of the Midnight Mission on Skid Row, the place that threw me out in 1958. Please, just set up a free will offering. And so yesterday morning, before the convention, I did something I doubt if any of you did. I got in my car at my big house by the ocean and drove down to Skid Row and walked around the buildings I do every morning, see who's dying and who survived the night, who smashed their head in the convulsions and who's on crack cocaine. Just dreadful. Then we spent the morning, my staff and I, trying to find ways to get these poor bastards to at least try to do something about it. It's very difficult. You don't get many off Skid Row, I'll tell you. But we get a few. In my home group, the Pacific group, almost every week there's someone who gets up there and thanks the Midnight Mission for their start. That's a great thing. But it's no big deal. You know, it isn't a matter of being wonderful. I never have become wonderful. I did pretty well in my about 40 years sober. I was really mature. But I've been going backwards ever since, it seemed like. Now I feel like I'm a 14-year-old boy trapped in an old body. Let's get out of here. Can't. Oh, shit. But the one thing you want to remember, tonight with the speaker you heard last night, with the speakers you heard all day today, tomorrow morning, Sharon gives her excellent talk. Oh, by the way, I almost forgot. I want to thank my hostesses, Tamara and Liz. They've done very little for me, but they look great. Tamara has the gown on tonight. I haven't seen a sight like that since I was weaned. I'm not judging at all. Don't judge. I don't judge it. But the one thing I want to leave with you all, with the new people especially, remember, you may think Alcoholics Anonymous, all the big days were in the old days they talk about. AA tonight, in this hotel, in this city, in this state, is exactly the same as it was June 10th, 1935 in Akron, Ohio. Not mystical. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to lower his feelings of being different, at least enough that he will maybe take an action he does not yet believe in. When that moment comes, that is the ember of a continuing life of sobriety. Take care of it. Thank you.